Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to a brand new Arsblog Arscast right here on arsblog.com. How are you? Hope you're well. As you can hear, my voice is a little better from where it was on Monday. That was after a weekend of carousing and gallivanting and late night hijinks with the Arsenal Vision crew after the event that we had on Saturday night, as well as being at football. You know, you've got to shout at things when you're at football, and that had a damaging effect on my vocal cords. But I'm getting there, and I'm feeling a little more human after a couple of days of rest at home. But what an amazing weekend, and what an amazing thing to be back at Arsenal to watch a game of football again. I know I spoke to James about this on the Arscast Extra on Monday, but it was great. It was great. I always knew I missed it, but I didn't quite realize how much I missed it. And just being back around the stadium, match day, all of that stuff, it was fucking great. And I cannot wait to do it again. So we'll get on board with all that next season, early next season as well. So here we are. Season's over. We are where we are. We finished where we finished. That discussion, I think, has been done to death. And we're now looking forward a little bit. But we are going to talk about how the season ended and some reflections on that with my guest in a couple of moments' time. Just a little bit of housekeeping, if you want to call it housekeeping. I don't know what else you call it. Just podcast nonsense, waffle. Anyway, the point is, what I'm trying to say is that for the event on Saturday, we got a load of Arsblog badges made up. Just the Arsblog logo on the little pin badges. Our good friend Will from @N5N7 Badges did all the heavy lifting there, so thank you very much indeed to him. And everyone who came to the show was given a free badge, but we had some left over. So if you want an Arsblog badge, you can get one for free right now at the Tollington. They have the rest of them there. So why not, during these next couple of weeks, pop in, have a pint, have a bite to eat, and get yourself a free Arsblog badge. I think if you are going in, you should probably buy a pint. That seems fair, doesn't it? Then it's not necessarily a free badge, but you're going to have a pint anyway. It's going to be a warm summer's day. You can sit out in the beer garden, watch the world go by, drink your cool, cool beer, and behold the splendor of this enamel badge. I might be overselling it a bit here, but look, if you want one, that's where they are. They're in the Tollington. And if you get one, why not just post it on Twitter, post it to me, and post it to the Tollington's Twitter account, and we'll say thank you and hello and all that kind of stuff. A few people have asked what the podcast situation is going to be like during the summer. It will be the same schedule, of course. We'll do Monday Arscast Extra. We will do regular Arscast on a Friday. And we'll keep things going over on Patreon as well, with some extra podcasts and bits and pieces for you. Transfer podcasts come into play. And we'll do as much as we can do for everybody. I am taking a bit of a holiday in July, so that'll be a week off. But a week will absolutely fly by, particularly as by that stage in July, I'm sure we'll have made all the high quality signings we're going to make for the summer. The squad is settled, all there for preseason. Nobody needs to talk about anything. We just want the football to start again. Anyway, look, I'll tell you more about that closer to the time, but just forewarned is forearmed and all that kind of stuff. Right, let's get on with today's show. And with me, I am delighted to welcome back, as always, Philippe Auclair. Bonjour, Philippe.
Bonjour, Andrew. Ça va? Très bien, I think. Well, no, not très, but like slightly bien. I think slightly bien is okay. It was a big weekend last weekend. I'm still recovering, doing my best. Three nights on the trot. When you get to a certain age, it takes a lot out of you. You know how it goes.
Yes, I do. Actually, I really do.
So look, let's start by me asking you on your reflections on the end of the Premier League season for Arsenal, fifth place. The dust has settled a little bit now on what was, I think everybody would accept a disappointing last couple of weeks, but with a little bit of time to consider and to ponder where we are, what we've done, how we've got there, and all the rest. How do you sum up the season?
I think I'm a bit Vicky Pollard about it. Yes, but no, but I would finish with a yes.
Okay.
So more yes than no, more up than down, more satisfied than disappointed, even though there's a bit of disappointment, but there's perhaps more satisfaction.
Okay.
I mean, in fairness, if you look at the disappointment perhaps is the fact that this was an ideal season in which perhaps to grab a place in the top four with Manchester United imploding every weekend, which of course was extremely funny, but should have really helped us. Spurs having problems as well at the beginning of the season and their change of manager. Fortunately, they got a rather good one. But of course, no competition in Europe, so which meant that we could concentrate 100% on the league. And despite that, just fell at the last hurdle. And as well, when you look at, and I'm actually doing it right now, I'm looking at the list of fixtures throughout the season, and I'm groaning.
Yeah.
Because I remember the beginning, there was COVID in the ranks and so forth, and preseason hadn't been what it should have been, but to start with three defeats and be a 20th after three games. Then the positive side, so that was the no but, the yes but comes in, and you think, well, from this position we were able to come back, and we had actually a really, really good 4 months in the season, something which we haven't had for a long time, in which perhaps the only disappointment was the draw against Burnley in late January. But apart from that, I mean, it was win after win after win, and a game against Manchester City, which probably was the best performance we gave, I think, all season, the first 45 minutes. So you think, there are loads of signs that things have been improving. If you look at what's been happening on the pitch, the fact that we seem to score quite regularly from set pieces these days is an interesting and welcome development. As is the pendant to that development, which is the fact we concede very few from those situations compared to the past. So progress has been made. But again, the disappointment is that we've lost key players at key times, and it's really highlighted the fact that this squad, even though the first 11 or first 13 is of excellent quality and can really challenge for, a place in the top six or top four, what is behind is not quite to level required of that. When we compare with the other clubs, it's just... Well, there's no comparison. And I was actually looking at something that Kieran McGuire, of The Price of Football, has done. And he's compared the place, the positions in the Premier League table to the positions in what I would call the wage bill table. And you look at that and you realize that despite the fact we do spend a lot of money on player salaries, we're nowhere near the guys from the top four. Nowhere. There's a differential of something like almost like £100 million, which is huge. So basically you get what you pay for. And I think we got pretty much what we paid for. And you can hear me saying one thing and not saying the contrary, but there is always a qualifier when we say this was great. Even when we talk about the performances of the players, we could say Thomas Partey, he was great, but when he was playing... Oh, Tomiyasu, what a wonderful signing. Yeah, but he got injured. And you carry on like that.
Yeah.
So if you're generous, and I want to be generous, I think you could see it as a season of transition, which has also been a season of progress, and in which some problems have been solved, not all of them, You know, we had the Aubameyang situation to go through as well, which was not exactly pleasant, but the team seemed to survive and to go through it and not to be too shocked or put in disarray by you know, what followed.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, there's regrets. I mean, we were so close. And you think as well of those three games, Andrew, in April against Palace, Brighton and Southampton. You think not one single point from those three games.
Yeah.
And then we take nine from games against Chelsea, Manchester United and West Ham. I mean, how crazy is that?
I mean, how does that... you know, because you could, and I think I have in some ways driven myself a bit mad looking at all the things, you know, like you say, those three games where we got no points. And I think back to the Everton game. Everton hadn't won a game in about 3 years before they played us. They didn't win a game for about 3 years after they played us, but somehow managed to beat us. And I think of those games, I think of, you know, various things, various incidents that could have gone our way that didn't quite go our way. There were, you sent me a little message, before we started recording, the Premier League table without VAR, and we finish in fourth place on 73 points, and that doesn't even take into account games like Everton away when they should have been down to 10 men, Palace home when they should have been down mm-hmm. to 10 men. And I look at where we are, and I look at where we finished, and I look at how close we came to the top four with some very, very important pieces missing from this squad. You know, a consistent regular striker. We know we needed something else in midfield. We miss Tomiyasu, we miss Kieran Tierney, we miss Thomas Partey, all of those things. And I'm slightly encouraged by the ability to get to that point with all those flaws. And then there's another part of me, of course, which, you know, has to acknowledge that as a club, or, you know, talking about Mikel Arteta, talking about the technical director, the board, all of those people involved, they made decisions which played into some of missing pieces, or whatever you want to call it, you know. So it is possible to sort of look and think, if only, on so many levels.
Yep. Yes, but I think that we're completely agreed. We're having conversation, the two of us, but we're having a conversation with ourselves at the same time.
Mm.
Is that, I think we've all been, it has been almost every single chat I've had with other Arsenal fans after the games, you know, when you look at what's happened at the barn or whatever. And it's always, it was a great day, but it was a terrible day, but, you know, they're still young, you know, progress and so forth. So it's always been, it's been like one of those slightly melancholy autumn skies where there is some sunshine but loads of clouds coming.
Mm.
Maybe I should say the spring, because the autumn is followed by winter and we don't want that. So maybe one of those moments, perhaps in March, when you think there's a sign of spring in the air, but there's always a cloud which is there to, you know, to ruin it for you.
Yeah.
And say, oh no, no barbecue today. No, no, no. No Champions League. No Champions League. But, you know, Arsenal is back in Europe, by the way, which is, okay, it's only the Europa League. But I think it will be welcomed by most fans, the prospect of seeing football played at the Grove on winter nights and spring nights, we hope.
Sure.
Something which we have missed, honestly. I mean, financially, it's also a big blow, obviously, because the differential is just colossal. The differential is probably the equivalent of the acquisition of a very, very, very good player.
Yeah.
So that's not too good. We don't want to think too much about that.
I was going to raise this a little bit later on, but we've had a couple of contract extensions this week. Mohamed Elneny, who I think is a very good squad player.
Yep.
I think is a useful player, given his experience and everything else. And I think just in terms of his character, somebody who understands his role, that he's not going to be a starter. He's not going to be the main man if we can keep people fit. But we know we've got a long season and not everybody stays fit. So I think on that basis, you know, it made a lot of sense to me to give him a deal. It's a 1 year plus 1 year option, which the mm-hmm. club can choose to take up. So you're not hamstringing yourself. It is not like giving Willian £200,000 a week for 3 years. You know, it's not that kind of a deal. It doesn't stand in anyone's way, and it makes sense. But the other one is Eddie Nketiah, who had a good end to the season. And it looked for a while as if he was going to go, and now it appears that he's going to stay. And you reference the disparity in money between the Europa League and the Champions League. And I do wonder if, in some way, his future from an Arsenal perspective has been decided by that disparity. That if you had that money, maybe you push the boat out for another forward. Whereas without it, you have to say, okay, we can't do that. We've got to find another solution. They wanted to keep Eddie anyway. I'm not just saying they want to keep him because we don't have that money, but I do feel like perhaps that fed into the what looks like to be the likely outcome of this situation.
It's a tricky one because also as far as Nketiah himself is concerned, if the club gets another proven class striker, which I certainly hope and I think they will, he's going to be number two. He's not going to play an awful lot because Arteta doesn't play with two strikers and he can't play the withdrawn striker. He's a fox in the box. Mm. That's the first thing. I'm very much of the dubitative kind when it comes to this contract. I agree with you entirely with Mohamed Elneny. I think it's an excellent idea. It's great for the players, great for the club. We're all happy. The fans like him. He likes us. He gets it. You know, welcome. You can stay, please. But Nketiah, I mean, my appraisal of him has changed a bit, I must say, this season. Because before that, if I'm absolutely honest, and I think we've spoken about Eddie a few times in the past, perhaps maybe not always with the microphone on, I've never thought he was up to the level required of a Premier League striker, ever. I think that technically his first touch is not that good enough. And I don't think it's going to progress much. I think that he's not skillful enough. Sorry to say that. It's a bit brutal. He's a great finisher. He's very brave. I absolutely loved that header against Everton, which I thought that was absolutely superb. That was pure reaction. That was pure instinct. Proper instinct in the box. But I genuinely didn't think that he had the qualities required. And what he's done towards the end of the season makes you think, well, actually, you know, it's perhaps this opinion is tainted by the fact that, A, we've had some extraordinarily skillful strikers in the past at our club. We've been very lucky with that. Mm-hmm. And we expect a certain level of skill and elegance, I suppose, or class or style from our forwards, which he doesn't have. He's more a Trezeguet than an Henry, for example. But on the other hand, I'm thinking, actually, having a Trezeguet in your team is no bad thing. Even if sometimes it is like playing 10v11 until the moment when, you know, he puts the ball in the net. So you can hear, yet again, I'm really divided here. Again, I'm not absolutely sure I understand the logic for the player or for the club. He's, I don't think, good enough to be our number one striker. I hope I'm proved wrong if he is to be indeed. And, you know, the numbers over the end of the season are fine, but those kind of purple patches tell you very little about the player. That's not what you should base your opinion of a player on. What you can see is that, obviously, his state of mind was right, that his dedication was absolutely faultless, that he was able to perform at a time when it was perhaps difficult for him to do so. He was not perhaps put in the best conditions by the staff either. Mm. So well done to him. But beyond that, I'm still dubitative.
Do you think that
because also you have but you also think that you have to have a striker who somehow will dovetail with the work of the people around him and look at the players around him, and you know they are very, very technically skilled players, all of them. You know, you talk about Odegaard, you talk about Smith Rowe, Saka, Martinelli. My goodness, we are blessed in this, as far as this is concerned. But somehow for me it doesn't quite fit in.
It is a bit of a strange one, considering for a long time it looked, or well, the rationale for him not signing a new deal was because he wanted to play more often, play more regularly. I agree with you. I don't think he's ever going to be good enough to be the number one striker at Arsenal, but I do wonder if he might be good enough to be the backup, the number two, the off-the-bench guy, the guy you can throw on in the penalty box, the guy who can start the Europa League group games, the guy who could allow, let's say, Follorin Balogun to go on loan again next season, which I think would probably be the most beneficial thing for him, having played just half a season of senior football. I really think that he's got to go and do it again for a full season, continue playing against big, strong men and learning what that's all about. So there's that aspect to it. And then I wonder as well, if in some ways it's Arsenal thinking, okay, you know, maybe he can do what we need him to do for a season or two seasons, and rather than lose a player for free, we're going to get some kind of return on him beyond what you might just get from a tribunal if he'd left on a Bosman as well. And I think one of the issues I've had down the year, I don't think that's the only reason they're giving him a deal or anything like that, but, you know, I know we've spoken about the need to be better at selling and moving players on, and when we move players on, and getting some return on the investment that we put into young players. And to be fair, there have been a couple in recent years who've come through our academy, who've made the breakthrough into the first team, who've been given another contract and have then been moved on for pretty decent money. I'm thinking Alex Iwobi and Joe Willock. So in that sense, I wonder if that played into the thinking with Eddie, rather than it just being, okay, he's the guy we need. It's like, okay, we can use him, but also when the time comes, we're going to be able to shift him and perhaps invest some of that money as well.
Yes, well, that makes sense to me, on condition that they already have identified other players, or the player, or maybe another two players who could play in that role as a central striker. There's one thing which I'm still puzzled about. And I know I go on a bit about that, like a stuck needle in the phonograph, but I still don't understand why Gabriel Martinelli is not tried at number nine. I just don't understand for the life of me.
He spoke himself about how his favourite position is on the left-hand side, coming in from that left-hand side. I agree with you. I would
have liked
to have
seen it, when Thierry arrived from Juve, he thought he was a winger.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a big comparison to make, but I know exactly what you mean, because, you know, towards the end of the season when Lacazette was, how will I put this, dwindling, his influence was dwindling, diminishing game by game, I really thought that Martinelli down the middle ahead of Nketiah was something I would have liked to see. And fair play to Eddie. He came on, he's done well, he scored goals that, like he scored goals that Lacazette could not have scored. So he made a fairly telling contribution in what he allowed the team to do and how he allowed the team to play. But it has been something that I've been pondering myself, Martinelli on the left-hand side. So, down the middle, sorry.
For Emil Smith-Rowe.
Yes. But of course, Smith-Rowe has not really been fit in the second half of the season as well. So that might well play a part. But perhaps when we think about the shape of the squad, the makeup of the squad for next season, Martinelli as another centre-forward option is one that we can consider. I do want to talk about what we might do in some key positions, but I think we probably just need to have a word about Mikel Arteta, about the manager, before we push on with that. He's at a point in his career where I think the learning curve is very steep, right? Still, even though he's been here a couple of years, he's a very young manager, still quite inexperienced and everything else. And I suspect the last few years for him have been pretty incredible, just from the perspective of getting a job like this, dealing with all the issues, player issues, pandemic, financial issues, no fans in the stadium, you know, being on the brink and pulling himself back from the brink and all of those kind of things. But is there one takeaway you think he might take from this season? Is there one lesson you feel that has been crucial for him as we go into another season where, you know, he has raised the expectations now. We didn't quite get there, but we're back in Europe and we've got to stay in Europe, and people are looking for us to take another step forward under him. So do you reckon there's one thing or one thing in particular that he might take from this campaign and think, okay, we've got to do better there?
I think he's now set his tactical objectives are clearer. I also think that he now has a first 13 in mind, which he didn't have before, because, you know, which is normal. But I think that we, and, you know, because now we take it for granted throughout the season, every time we saw the team sheet, we thought, as expected. Well, as expected this season, he's now got a settled side, which he didn't have before. There are still some question marks, obviously, about the midfield. I still have some question marks about central defense myself, but I don't have any question marks about the fullbacks, if indeed they can play, they are fit to play.
The first choice fullbacks, the questions would be about...
Absolutely. Cedric is perfectly fine deputy. I don't have any problem with that, but we're missing another one. Well, it depends who it depends who you're playing against. You're not going to have, you know... Are you playing the League Cup? Are you playing the Europa League? Are you playing Premier League against Manchester City? I mean, it's different. You might not be the same personnel. Also, we have a keeper who seems to have been in that position for a couple of years now, which is not the case. He has a settled side. He has settled the side. He's dealt... I mean, the Aubameyang situation must have been extremely difficult to deal with. And he did it, I think, as well as he possibly could, given his character, his temperament. He can appear too intense. He can appear a bit too rigid sometimes. But again, as you say, he's only 40 years old. He's one of the youngest managers in the league. Actually, is he the youngest in the league? Was it?
Yes, I think he is. Yeah.
He is, yes. So to have gone that far, having already also a trophy, and not a small trophy, to show for his work, which we shouldn't forget, was only 2 years ago. I think, yes, for him, he's matured in the position. I do think that, yes, he has a much clearer idea, I think, of what he wants to do with that particular group of player. Is he going to be flexible enough is the question I'm asking myself. Because... it's one thing to have a settled side, but I don't know if you've got the same impression, but I got the impression that it was not just a settled side. It had settled to the extent it was not made of, what a comparison, settled not like a jelly.
Okay.
Which you can melt and reshape in a different mold, but settled like a block of concrete.
Sure.
I mean, this is really not the best simile I've ever come with, but it will do.
I know what you mean in that, like, he settled on something that worked and I either couldn't or didn't have the ability to change it sufficiently. There wasn't enough variety in what we could do. Is that kind of fair?
Yeah, that's that kind of thing. And, you know, a bit still the idea... oh, we are going to impose our game, and this is how we're going to win that game, because we're going to impose our game. We didn't necessarily take into consideration the identity, the kind of style of our opponents. The other thing as well, in which there is a problem, and I don't know if it's down to the manager, I do not understand how Arsenal seems incapable to change shifts in a game. Change gears in the game. It's one thing when you are at one of the grounds where we're playing. I think after 2 minutes max, you know what kind of game you're going to see, and you know that it's going to be either fantastic tempo and so forth, a few goals, then basically shake with fear for the last 15 minutes because we let one in. Or is it going to be one of those when every player is touching the ball three times more than he should, is passing laterally, diagonally, and so forth, and there's no tempo, no rhythm? And You sense it immediately. And the team, for some reason, perhaps it is because it is young, because it is inconsistent, doesn't seem to have this ability to suddenly find an extra gear. And you have to, at one point, when this happened game after game after game after game, you start to wonder if the players are not a little bit too formatted in a way, and that they do not have quite the temperament on one hand, but also the nous, but also the encouragement to do so.
Yeah, this goes back to what we and you very often used to say about Arsene Wenger being, you know, a jazz guy in terms of his team. Like, Mikel Arteta's Arsenal feel a bit like an orchestra that's tuned to do exactly this thing and do it amazingly, but there isn't enough improvisation. There's no guy who just whips out a trumpet and starts playing his own fucking tune. You know what I mean? So yeah. I agree with you on that, and certainly the ability to come back from losing positions, because when we go ahead, our record is fantastic. When we go behind, it's really not very good at all. And I think that becomes something of a psychological barrier that you have to get over as a team. Like, you can see sometimes, like even the game against Newcastle, I know there were some mitigating factors. I know that there were players running on empty in that particular game, and the occasion was something that got to them as well. But when that first goal went in, you knew it was done and dusted. And I think the players, yep, in their own way, as much as they tried, knew it was done and dusted as well, because it's not something that we're particularly good at. So that is part of what we've got to improve on. I absolutely agree. And an
illustration of how black and white, red and green we are. I mean, we actually have one more win in the league than Chelsea.
Yeah.
We won one more game. We've drawn only three games in the whole season. Yeah. That's crazy. I don't know. The Invincibles, I think we drew 11 or something like
12.
That. 12. There you go.
Yeah.
So we drew three games, and we won one more game than Chelsea. That proves that it's a kind of all or nothing kind of team.
Yeah. Should make a documentary about that.
Full gas, or we are reversing.
Yes.
It's one or the other, and that is a little bit of concern. I'm sure that's a thing that Arteta and his coaches are looking at to try and understand why it is that we're so, I don't know, we say cyclothymic in French, but maybe it exists in English. I'll use it anyway. But it's tout l'un, tout l'autre. One thing or the other. Never. We seem to have one identity for each game.
Yeah.
And that's it. And we can keep it for a series of games, as we did in the winter, most of the winter. But other times, suddenly you see Mr. Bad Arsenal comes to town. And as the little girl in Tennyson's poem, when she was very, very bad, she was horrid. and so we have been. And that's the one question mark. Because also, you know, when you say some of the players were running on empty when we played against Newcastle, how many of these players played more than 40 games in the season?
No, I know. I mean, I don't necessarily think it was a fatigue thing. I think it was, you know, an injury. Injury thing. Gabriel had a hamstring problem. Ben White had a hamstring problem, which, you know, was quite serious towards the end of the season. Tomiyasu went off. So I think there were just those elements to it. It wasn't really that I think they should be absolutely fatigued, because they shouldn't have been, but because the squad was small, because we couldn't really rotate as much as we would have liked to, we ended up with players who were perhaps a little more affected by injury. And look, I think one way of dealing with this particular thing, you can coach your way out of it, you can have psychological sessions and all the rest of it, but adding quality to the squad is another really important way of making yourself better and making your team more able to cope with in-game situations which don't go according to plan. I mean, I do think you have to plan for things which don't go according to plan, if that doesn't sound counterintuitive. But what do you think so far of some of the names that have been linked with the club to help give us that extra bit of quality and depth. Gabriel Jesus is the main striker target, as we know. Yuri Tillemo is the midfield target. I've even seen, and I don't know how real this is because we're just right at the start of the transfer window and it feels like this could be perhaps the most chaotic, mayhemish transfer window of all time because each one seems worse than the last, summer after summer.
It's going to be awful. Yeah. I mean, what with the new ownership at Chelsea and what with the Saudis at Newcastle, this is going to be terrible.
But I've seen mention of Serge Gnabry as a potential target for Arsenal. How realistic that might be, you know, you can all make your own minds up on that one. But those are names that have been doing the rounds. And certainly the first two that I mentioned, Jesus and Tillemo, are very much on the Arsenal list. So do they give you some encouragement as we start to dip our toes into the murky water of the transfer window?
Totally. And that is absolutely no hesitation. I would be absolutely delighted to see one or the other player, or even better, both playing for our shirt next year. Jesus, I think, would fit in. I mean, it's exactly what I was talking about, dovetailing with our other attacking players. I think he would dovetail perfectly with our other forwards. He certainly would be... I mean, he's shown how versatile he was. And... he's okay. He's not the top striker. Okay. He's not Robert Lewandowski. Fine. Dybala is another one, by the way, who's been mentioned quite a few times, but it seems that he loves Italy too much to leave it. But I would have absolutely no problem with Gabriel Jesus. The only thing that makes me wince a little bit is the amount of money that apparently Manchester City would like to get for a player who's has never been the number one striker and who has only got, you know, a year left on his contract. And they seem to want an awful, awful lot of money for that. And that, I'm not too sure about this. Tielemans, I'm an absolute fan of the player. It's actually a player that I've followed for quite a long time because I do have quite a few friends in Belgium football, and who a long time ago alerted me to this young man saying, he is the real article. He's the real article. He's got absolutely everything. He's also very smart. He's incredibly mature. And I do think as well, he would be in a team that would suit his style absolutely perfectly. This doesn't address, by the way, the fact that I still think that we are a bit short in the field of so-called enforcers or players who've got greater physical presence in midfield than we have presently. And I know Thomas Partey is physically very impressive, but he's not that kind of player. I really want Thomas Partey being able to drive at players, you know. And I'm not sure he's. I think we're all missing this player who maybe doesn't exist. But you know, I've just seen, like, for example, Boubacar Camara has been taken on by Aston Villa. And I'm thinking, oh my God, no, I wanted him. He was free as well. You know, probably a big salary, but he was free. And I thought, oh my gosh. It's like these players like, Cavaminga or Aurélien Tchouaméni or, you know, Boubacar Camara, which France seems to produce at an incredible rate these days. But I think we could do with one. And Tillemans is not that, but he's something else. And for example, the way he could link up with Odegaard in particular, I'd love to see that because he's a creator. He's a great tempo setter. I think also he's whereas Xhaka has got wonderful qualities in terms of his passing, but only in certain contexts. He finds it much more difficult, as we know, when there's little time and little space on the ball. Tillemans is much more at ease when there's more pressure, I think. And he's very calm. We haven't seen the best of him, okay, this season. He's had his problems. And I think, in a way, he was symptomatic of the problems of his whole team, of his whole club, which perhaps is also in need of renewal at the moment. And we shouldn't take, you know, don't think of him as being the player that we saw last season. And because he's much, much better than that. Think of the one, you know, 2 years ago, 3 years ago. He's a superb midfielder. He will bring imagination. And the range of passing is honestly wonderful. But it's not just that. He can also become, I think, a goal-scoring midfielder, which is something which is a bit missing from his game at the moment. It's something we have been missing as well a lot, a goal-scoring midfielder, you know.
Yeah.
After waxing lyrical about this young Belgian chap, I can conclude if we got those two, I would think that this had been an absolutely superb transfer window.
I mean, clearly there's more to do than that, but those two would definitely add real quality to the squad. And I think the debate over midfield and what else we might need in there, because I think a lot of people would share your desire for having a bit more of a physical presence in midfield. But if we're looking at an Odegaard, Tielemans, and a six in the shape of Thomas Partey, or somebody who can deputize for Thomas Partey, whether that's Albert Sambi-Lokonga as he develops, or somebody else, or Granit Xhaka even, we'll have to wait and see. And I think that one will play out. But I just want to move on to another addition to the squad.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's a brand new year, and what better time to get going with that online store you've been thinking of? Those "I was there when Arsenal actually scored a goal" t-shirts would fly off the shelves right now. And to get yourself up and running, you need Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way through to the did we hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms, and sell more with less effort with thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 a month trial period at shopify.com/arsblog, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/arsblog now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/arsblog.
Yep.
That it looks like we're going to make, and at long last, it seems that William Saliba is going to play a role for Arsenal next season. I'll just read some quotes that Mikel Arteta gave during the week after his loan spell at Marseille, where he was in he was the young player of the year in Liga, I believe.
And yes, he was.
Mikel Arteta says he has to come back. He has the experience and the environment necessary to be competitive with us. If he had stayed with us this year with one Premier League game per week and with Ben White and Gabriel, he wouldn't have had half the playing time he had with Marseille. That's for sure. For his growth and what he can do next season, that wouldn't have been good. And basically he's saying, look, the loan spell to Marseille was the right thing for the player and the right thing for what I would assume is a longer-term plan for William Saliba, despite the fact that I think there's a perception that Mikel Arteta hates him or doesn't like him or whatever it is. And I'm not saying that Arsenal have handled this particular player as well as they might have, because I think there have been some issues. But for me, a 20-year-old, 19-year-old, 20-year-old central defender going out on loan rather than being thrown to the wolves at Premier League level made a lot of sense, regardless of, you know, how much people have invested in him, regardless of his price tag or anything like that. So when we think about the centre of our defence next season, we have Ben White, we have Gabriel, Rob Holding is Rob Holding. And William Saliba is a, you know, physically a very impressive young man. He can play on the right. He can play on the left of a two in the center of defense. He could have a very good role with us. So I'm curious as to your thoughts on him. And I know you watched an interview that he did. Some of the quotes were reported in the press in England, and your interpretation of those quotes as well.
Yes, let's start with that, because by reading some of the headlines of the pieces you'll have seen in some British media and some French media too, you would get the impression that the player, if he wanted, if he could do what he really wanted to do, would stay at Marseille and would become a full-time Marseille player. Let's not forget that his contract ends up in 2024, if not mistaken, with Arsenal.
Yeah.
And Marseille probably would have the money to put a bid for him, especially since they've now qualified for the Champions League. And he was saying basically that he would be looking forward to playing on Tuesday and Wednesday evenings in the Champions League. And so forth. And when you heard it, to start with, you thought, well, it doesn't sound like a player who is really desperate to go back to Arsenal into the Premier League. It didn't sound like it. And then you think, well, okay, he was talking just after qualifying for the Champions League with Marseille, okay? Mm-hmm. So on the high. The atmosphere was absolutely phenomenal around the team, with the team, with the fans and everything. So that's another thing to keep in mind. He was also talking to French journalists and journalists from the regional press, and obviously would want to say things, nice things to these people.
Of course, play the crowd like.
A bit, yeah, absolutely. So you put all that together, you think, well, maybe not. But it was not, I have to say, the most enthusiastic embracing of a prospect of playing in London next season. I've heard more positive than that.
Okay.
And so it might be a question of convincing the player that, you know, he does really have a future. Because the other thing, you know, he played 36 league games with Marseille this season. Basically, he was their number one defender. Being named the best young footballer in Ligue 1 is not exactly meaningless. So he now has a status which he didn't have before. Because let's be clear that this year was somebody who was a great talent, who had shown, but a little bit inconsistent at times. Suddenly, he went into another dimension with Marseille. I'm not exaggerating when I'm saying that. And he would expect to have, I think he would expect to be a starter at Arsenal, which is a bit of a problem, isn't it?
Well, I think that expectation and that ambition and that level is a good thing in a way.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, from his perspective. And I want there to be a scrap. I want there to be a fight. I want there to be competitiveness in our squad. I know we've talked a bit about the idea of a settle back four, and that can be really beneficial. But also, players lose form, and you've got to deal with that. So if he's coming willing to fight and all that kind of stuff, like I get that he doesn't want to come back to any club after playing regularly. Why would you want to go and sit on the bench anywhere? I get that. That's normal.
That's absolutely normal. What I'm saying is that, when we talk about...
It's something we've got to deal with, though, yeah.
He has the talent to become a number one choice.
Mm.
I don't think there's any doubt about that. And given the luck we have with injuries and sending offs and suspensions in the back four, I think he will have plenty of games to play in any case. But he would be, he will be, hopefully, a great recruit as well. Mm. Honestly, I mean, he was superb with Marseille. And, his lack of enthusiasm is something which people shouldn't feel too uneasy about. I have to say, I thought the interview was a bit... It made me ask myself a few questions about his commitment. But then afterwards, you put that back into the context and you think, oh, come on, he's just qualified Champions League with that club. Of course, he's going to say he wants to play Champions League with it. Of course, he's talking were, and local papers, he's going to tell them exactly what they want to hear. He wants, he's just shared a fantastic moments with the fans. He wants to please the fans, and the fans would love him to stay, but no, he's probably going to go back to Arsenal, and will, you know, the club will actually get a very, very fine central defender. I was going to say for no money, but we actually paid a lot of money for him a few years ago. So
we did.
We're finally going to see the colour of that money.
Hopefully. And I was just, while we were talking, I was looking up some of the former winners of the Liga Young Player of the Year. Some reasonable names in there. Pires, Henri, Trezeguet, Zidane, Eden Hazard. Yeah. Couple of decent, some pedigree in that situation. Look, before we go, there were a couple of things I just want to talk about outside of Arsenal, because we've got a whole summer ahead to pore over what Arsenal can do and will do and all the rest of it. But I just wanted to talk to you about the Premier League season as a whole and some of the aspects of that, and the fact that Man City have won their fourth Premier League title in 5 years. I said this on the podcast with James on Monday. It just completely leaves me cold and indifferent to the champions of England, if that is a weird way of putting it. But like,
no.
It's just like I look at it and go, well, yeah, okay. It's not interesting to me. I don't find them enjoyable to watch. And some people might say, well, that's sour grapes. You'd love it if you were playing, you know, winning 4 out of 5 titles. And yes, of course I would. But I just find it impossible to separate myself from what it really is, if that makes sense.
It makes complete sense. And I think that's a very healthy attitude to have. And I think my own perception, obviously, when I report on them, I try to put this at the back of my mind, which is not always easy. But saying that, I'm always also present in mind the fact that this is a particular project, which is based on a vision of sport, which I find execrable. It is dirty money. I say dirty money because it comes from a country which has got an even worse human rights record than Qatar, which is something that is never said or not said enough, and that this is something which is completely sports washed, put under the carpet. They are never confronted by it or with it, and to be honest, they shouldn't be in football. The fact that they've created a team that is so successful, you could say, you can admire the way in which this has been put together. It is a very well thought out project. It's got some extraordinarily capable people in there. They've also spent more money than anybody else in world football, apart from PSG, I believe. We won't even talk about Barcelona because Barcelona is just mad and it's different anyway. But they have put more money than anybody else in English football. They are paying higher wages than anybody else in English football. Yeah, okay, all right. Should I get excited about that? No, not really, actually. And the fact is that Manchester City fans themselves, I think, are fully aware of it, and they live in a state of constant delusion. And they transform the fact that they themselves have got a problem with their own team, and they prefer to project that on the fans of other teams who actually look at them and say, you know, your titles are worth nothing. And so they get very angry, and this anger, which is in a way... Yes, this anger enables them to live with success, because if they looked at themselves properly, they would see what this project is. They would actually question how it has been put together. And they would also question what people call the beauty of that team's play, because I'm like you, it's a football that leaves me entirely cold. I just leaves me cold. And it's not because it's Manchester City and it comes from its golf money and so forth. Because, for example, I'll tell you, I've seen PSG play some football, which I thought was fantastic. And I don't have, because it's crazy. It's a bit crazy. There's a place for improvisation again. There is not this idea that everything has been repeated. I mean, the players, Bernardo Silva, beautiful player. Kevin De Bruyne, genius. Gundogan, I would love Gundogan. Come here, my friend.
Yeah.
Joao Cancelo, what a fullback. And you carry on, you go through it, you think, wonderful players. And whatever your feelings are about Guardiola as a person, as a character, and also as a public person who I think totally fails to own and acknowledge where he, you know, what exactly he is doing and with whom,
mm-hmm.
You have to admire the incredible technician that no doubt he is, and the thinker that he is. That you can do all those things. But then you must have also this, you also have present in mind constantly everything that accompanies that, and which in fact is the most important side of it. Just as the most important part of Newcastle is that it is built, it will be built with the money of a murderous regime. All the rest, I don't care about Newcastle. I just want them to lose every weekend with a vengeance.
How do you view the stories this week that David Kahn wrote in The Guardian this week about how there was government intervention to make sure that the
yes.
the Saudi Public Investment Fund takeover of Newcastle, and I want to be specific about that. It is the Saudi Public Investment Fund who are chaired by
Mohammed bin Salman,
Mohammed
the Crown
bin
Prince.
Salman, yes, you know, who... How do we as football fans reckon with that? How do we come to terms with the fact? And look, I know this goes without saying, but you know, we're Arsenal. We're owned by real estate billionaire from the US, sports mm-hmm. magnate, whatever you want to call him. We're sponsored by Emirates. We have our shirt sponsor with Rwanda. Yep. There are all these things that we as football fans have to come to terms with, the cognitive dissonance, whatever you want to call it. We're all there to a certain extent or another. But given what happened with Chelsea and given what happened with, you know, everything that's happened in the last little while, English football doesn't appear to have learned any kind of lesson in terms of who should own football clubs. I know they're private businesses and all of that kind of stuff, but it just seems like the things that could have been learned were just put to one side, and ultimately this just turns it into a bigger and better and grander and flashier and showbizier version of the reality TV of football, of Premier League football.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yes, yes. What can I say?
I just want to finish my point for one sec. As Arsenal fans, we're looking for success. We're looking for a team that can challenge for the title. We're looking for to recapture the glory days, the old days, if you want to call them that, you know, and be competitive again. And that's Mikel Arteta's aim. That's clearly his aim because he's talked about it time again. But is it realistic? Can it be realistic when the financial deck is stacked the way it's stacked and, like, it's Newcastle this time around and, you know, who might it be next season? Who might it be the season after that?
And I totally agree with you. And I think we can forget about that. I think the best we can hope for, unless something changes drastically in the way that football is managed and governed, is that top four is the absolute top of our ambition. And to be honest, it's going to be harder and harder because there is absolutely no doubt that with the financial clout of Newcastle, they will be fighting for it perhaps as early as this season, but certainly two or three seasons they should be there or thereabouts, because when you put, again, you know, I go back to this simple equivalence, the more money you spend on players, the more successful you are. It's an absolute rule. There are no exceptions. The only exceptions are people who underperform because they are crap. You look at Manchester United, for example, they underperform in that because they're very badly managed. That's all there. But the moment they're well managed, they'll be back. And that is a certainty. So as we cannot compete to that, and that Stan Kroenke doesn't quite have the same approach to sport as, say, Todd Boehly has, because Boehly, as you know, invested really big in the Dodgers and reaped the benefit. His fans also had to pay for it because the price of season tickets just went absolutely through the roof there. So Bully will do it. Kroenke, it's not his aim. Or we don't think so. Maybe he's going to have a weird Damascene moment late in his life as a football franchise owner. And I think we're coming to the moment, and it's clearer and clearer by the season, that we all have to ask ourselves some pretty big questions as to what we want to do with our love of football. I'm asking these questions to myself. I've been doing that for a long time, perhaps because of the nature of the journalistic work I do, the reporting I do. A lot of it is investigative reporting into the not so nice side of football, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
And the more it goes, the more disgusted I am, and the more I realize that it is utterly rotten to the core. And you think it cannot go worse, but in fact, the stench gets even stronger. And then you've got Newcastle arriving there. And then there'll be others. There was talk of the Bahrainis as well getting into football, buying a very big club recently. And you think, yes, what can we do about that? And the answer is, and then on the other hand, of course, you've got Florentino Perez, which is really lovely, as of course. And and the prospect of the Super League, and then you get the reform of the Champions League, and you think, you know, what the heck is going on here? We've completely lost control of that. And yes, we have to ask ourselves questions. I mean, for me, it means not wearing a replica shirt. I don't want to be promoting the airline of a certain airline. I don't want to be promoting a country in which people are thrown into prison for no good reason and tortured and worse. I don't want to be. So I can think, as fans, we can do that. You notice perhaps that I try not to use only when my tongue is betrayed. I don't necessarily refer to the stadium where we play our games by the name of its sponsor. And I think we can do that. I mean, these are very small things. And to be honest, in the great scheme of things, they don't really matter. But maybe they make me feel a bit better about it. Mm-hmm. But it's a genuine problem. We don't have it, you know, with our club as much as others would have it. I would add as well the fact to that people whose shirts are sponsoring betting corporations about which I shouldn't say too much because I know the libel laws in Ireland are quite strict. But, you know, we also, in a way, we are participating. We're willingly complicit with a side of the sports business, which is honestly disgusting.
Mm-hmm.
So it's everywhere. And so you end up, you know, I've asked myself, should I, you know, I've got a friend who is the chief executive of Lewis FC. I've been there. I thought, maybe I should become a Lewis FC member and be a fan there. It's a great club. They do things properly there. Or Sheffield Hallam, places like that, you know.
Yeah, it is something we all have to wrestle with. I feel like we've kind of ended this, what I thought was a very decent conversation, a good conversation about Arsenal, and on a kind of a bum note, and that's not your fault or my fault, that's just actually just talking about the reality of what football is. But, you know, maybe Philippe, you know, Liverpool have shown that if you're good and you're smart and you do things well, you can compete. I mean, I think
but they've got loads of money too.
Yeah,
I mean,
they
spend
do, of
a lot
course,
of money.
But,
but I have to say that the fact that, you know, when they've seen the Manchester City fans and even their manager are complaining all the time about that everybody supports Liverpool, which is certainly not true if you go to Manchester, there is a reason for that. It's because Liverpool are, I don't know, they've got a human face. The football they play, the personality of their manager and so forth, and of their players, we think actually, yes, that's the kind of football we like, you know? And it makes you feel almost, it normalizes it. It also normalizes, it makes people forget that I think over the last five seasons it is, or four seasons, Manchester City has gone past the 90 points in a season, ending once with 99 and the other with 100. That is just unbelievable. It's just so wrong. And because Liverpool has been able to compete at that kind of level almost all of the time with a different arsenal, so to speak, of weapons, we tend to forget the fact that City the whole thing, the Premier League is not competitive. It's a fallacy. The Premier League is a league in which games are fairly contested. Yes. But in the end, those games, fairly contested as they are not competitive. The league calendar is full of dead easy fixtures for Manchester City. They actually gain more points. That's what I actually did the calculation. I'm sorry to go on about that.
No, go.
I did the calculation for a column I did for Eurosport, which actually might not have been published yet. I had a look at the number of points accrued in the top leagues since Pep Guardiola arrived at Manchester City. To be honest, I could have gone before that, because there was also the Pellegrini's, you know, Manchester City was not exactly unsuccessful, and Mancini's either. So, but anyway, I chose Guardiola, and I looked at the number of points they had accrued. And you know what? They've accrued more points, like points per game, because Bundesliga is only, obviously, 34 games. More points than any other club in the world. Which means that we keep talking about those other leagues which are not competitive because Juve or Bayern or Real or PSG are crushing, eviscerating the opposition.
Mm.
Well, they do not dominate their league as much as Manchester City now does. And the only thing that makes us forget about that is the fact that Liverpool has been able to win the league once.
Yeah.
Once.
What if this Liverpool team had not emerged? Like this generation of Liverpool side had not emerged, and it was Man City winning the title by 10, 12, 15, 20 points after season.
Yeah.
It'd be a very different conversation. People would be, I think, even more fed up.
I think so. And you know, my apologies if there are Manchester City fans who are listening to that by extraordinary circumstances, probably because they've been tied and put in the cellar and with headphones on.
Forced to listen to an Arsenal podcast,
torture.
Yeah.
But yes, I think we, in also, I would say the media are complicit. That's too strong a word. But I think there is no willingness to actually address that. I mean, more and more people are doing it. It's true. When you read what Miguel Delaney is writing about, when Jonathan Wilson is writing about, when Barney Roney, I mean, Jonathan Liu, actually, I'm talking about The Guardian and The Independent here. And there are people who are voicing this opinion, you know, now, quite regularly. But on the other hand, you cannot spend your whole life. Imagine if you're a reporter, you're on the Manchester beat, and you go to all the Manchester City games, you're not going to write the same piece 19 times, you know, in a season. Or 19 or 25 times or 35 times. When you talk about what you see on the pitch. And I think as well that the aesthetic appreciation of Manchester City is completely warped. I do not understand it. I do not understand what's exciting about this team. I like to be excited in football, you know, and I don't understand it. I don't find them exciting.
Mm.
I find them really impressive. I find them sometimes quite admirable. But, and I absolutely love Kevin De Bruyne, and I love Bernardo Silva, and blah, blah, blah. I've said all that already. But I'm not excited. I'm excited, on the other hand, by Mo Salah and Luis Diaz, by the way. Oh, my God, what a player. Or Sadio Mane, or people like that.
Mm.
I will be even excited if I see... dare I say that? When I see Song Heung-min, I've got much more than admiration for him. I think he's a fabulous footballer, even though I have not a lot of time for the team that he plays for. And you don't get that with the boys in blue. And it's a project. It's a project. It's
artifice in a way, like well constructed.
Yeah, it's artifice. Yes.
Very smart. Very intelligent. With
super smart.
Yeah.
Super smart, super efficient, except in Europe, which is also hilarious.
Yes.
But if that is football, I really haven't got any interest in it. I really don't have any interest. And I have to write about it. It's fascinating to write about it from all sorts of angles, because in a way, the kind of football they practice is a football that is a project football, if you see what I mean. It's the kind of football that can be explained on the blackboard. And that makes a lot of sense when you think that it is a genuine project which has been thought in Abu Dhabi from A to Z with the help of countless consultants and so forth, in terms of we're going to get that technical team, we're going to do this with the stadium, we're going to do this with the training center, we're going to do this with the football group, we're going to own 10 football clubs or 15 football clubs on the planet, and we're going to do this with the youngsters and the academies, all right? And everything is planned. And on one hand, you think, wow, bravo, you know? Not many people have got, you know, this, the capacity to project themselves in the future that way and to apply what they've imagined in practice, and they've done that. And on that side, they are worthy of a certain kind of admiration. Admiration doesn't mean acceptation, by the way.
Yeah.
But on the other, you see the result and you, what it means for football. And the thing is, the Man City fans, you know, guys, I love some of you, but you are the most miserable lot in the country. You're winning everything. You still moan all the time. It's extraordinary. They're extraordinary.
At least when we moan, we're not winning most of the time.
No, we're not winning, and we moan. It's like there is moaning and moaning, you know. And I don't think we moan about the thing about what the fans of other teams think of us, because to be honest, I couldn't care less.
Mm.
You know, which is why I have some very good mates who are Spurs fans, because I really don't care what he thinks about my club. And reciprocally. So I've got some of my closest friends are Spurs supporters. And that's perfectly all right. On the other hand, I think I would find it very difficult to have this kind of friendship with a Manchester City supporter who also feeds on the fact that he thinks their team are hated. Is hated. And it's not hate. It's just like, it doesn't matter, my friend. This is why you're so pissed off and you're so paranoid, because you know it means absolutely nothing. You know that for all your titles, put them in an envelope, the one title won by Leicester is worth a pack of 500 envelopes that you've got. But it's true.
No, I don't disagree with you. I don't disagree
with
you.
It's true. You know, we want romance, we want glory, we want all these sort of things. Being fragile as well is another very important thing. And the only time I think when, you know, for example, another reason why people... neutrals are so taken, not just in England or the English-speaking world, but by Liverpool, is because Liverpool are imperfect. Mm. And they are fragile at some... And it's great because it makes it exciting, because there is, adversity to overcome, all these sort of things. It's great. Mm. And we are fragile. I wish we were fragile in a more Liverpool kind of way. But we are. And in a way, the fact, you know, when you, it's squeaky bum and 95th minute, we're hanging on at 2-1 and we get 2-1. What a relief. It's great. You feel great after that. I don't know. I mean, and they will never feel that. They will never feel that.
Hard to feel that when you're 7-0 up against Aston Villa or Norwich or whatever it is already.
Exactly. You need to lose more. If you haven't lost, you don't know how to win.
All right. How are you feeling after that? You feel better?
Yeah, thank you very much. You'll tell me how much I owe the therapy clinic.
This one's on the house. Don't worry.
Oh, that's great. And so, yeah, I feel much better about it. I have to say, I feel quite positive and optimistic about Arsenal. And you know what? We haven't mentioned that, but I think the most important thing perhaps this season for me is that every time I've been to the stadium, I have felt a crowd that had reunited with its team.
Mm.
And it's a great feeling.
100%.
It's a great feeling. The stadium is noisier than it's been in years. Honestly, it is noisy at times. There are some people moaning, but most of the people are actually doing the right thing. They're much more engaged. They love their players quite clearly. And the players actually, like, it's silly things. It's not silly, actually. Have you noticed how the players are much more willing now, rain or shine, win or lose, to go towards the fans at the end of the game?
Yeah.
And how the fans are staying longer at the game, after the game, to the whistle?
Even on Sunday, Philippe, you know, after the Everton game, after the disappointment of what happened in the week preceding that game, the stadium stayed, I won't say 100% full, but I would say 80% of people stayed for the lap of appreciation, because I think they wanted to transmit to the players that they appreciate the effort, they appreciate the connection, they enjoy it, they want more of it. I think we all want more of that. We all want more success together and happy times together. And, you know, I think it is quite something that, despite the pretty intense disappointment of what happened in the Derby and what happened against Newcastle, the good things that have happened this season have resonated or connected to a greater extent, to the point that people just want to share that end of season vibe with the players. And, you know, it's part of what we can build on for next season, for sure. You know, cultivate that, keep it going, make it noisy. You know, I don't know that the Emirates is ever going to be like the most intimidating stadium of all time, but I can tell you, you know, it can be a little morose sometimes, and for good reason, as it has been over the last number of years. There have been, you know, periods where things haven't been going well, but we all know the difference. We can all feel when it's good, we can all feel when it's fun, and that goes for the players as well.
And that is a lovely note to conclude our conversation with, Andrew. Okay. I think.
All right.
Much more upbeat.
Sure. Let's do that. Let's leave it there. Look, I really appreciate your time, as always. Hopefully we can catch up at some point during the summer as well. But for now, you can lift yourself up off the therapist couch, and we'll talk to you again soon. Thanks, Philippe.
Thank you very much, Sigmund.
Always great to talk to Philippe. You can follow him on Twitter. He is at Philippe Auclair. At Philippe Auclair. It was a long conversation, so I'm not going to waffle too much at the end here. The season is over, so we don't have anything to look forward to this weekend. There is, of course, the Champions League final taking place between Real Madrid and Liverpool, which should be an excellent game. Looking forward to that, as I always do, to the Champions League final. And look, I just want to say that after a brilliant weekend last weekend, and I had so much fun, it was great to see so many people, old friends and new, and to have an incredible experience. And it doesn't take much to be reminded of how lucky and how privileged you are to be able to do that and to enjoy that. The world can be a devastatingly brutal place at times. And when you see what's happened this week in America with school shootings and all the other things that are going on around the world, all I can say is remember what's precious and remember what's important. And it can be very easy to get caught up in stuff which really, at the end of the day, doesn't mean a great deal. So whatever you do this weekend, do it well with your friends, with your family, with the people you love, if you can do that. And maybe to spare a thought for those who can't or who won't be able to ever again because of something horrific or random or whatever it might be. Thank you for listening, as always, for listening all season. We've got through another one. We've got another one coming up before you know it. James and I will be here on Monday with an Arscast Extra. I hope you have a great weekend. I love you all. Mind yourselves, look after one another, and I'll catch you on the next one. Until then, cheers. Bye-bye.
Oh, hello. It's me. You know me. You might think, who the fuck is this guy? But let me tell you, you know me. It's that time of year, you see. Summer. The sun is shining. No, I'm not Johnny Hayfever, even though I think he does splendid work. Fantastic stuff. Who am I? I'm Trev Transfer. That's who I am. Like Cupid sitting on your shoulder bringing you love, except I make your brain rot with transfer rumors. There's no relief. I'm there every waking moment. I also haunt your dreams. I make you believe that a story in the Transfer Bible Tavern might be real, even though you know it's not. How could it be? I am the power behind your F5 button. Refresh, refresh, refresh. Even though you've just checked news now. Must check news now! And the best thing? Even when a transfer goes through and you've got that dopamine rush, it fades. And you want the next one. And the next one. The cravings kick in. The pangs. The wanting. And all the time, I'll be there.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.